All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special Hanukkah edition of Kabbalah and Coffee. So this is our first session in our new built-out, decked-out cafe space that is named in tribute to Jeff Krause, called Jeff's Place. You see the sign up there, Jeff's Place. Jeff was a young man who joined us on occasion at Kabbalah and Coffee, who passed away tragically at a very young age, and the space is dedicated to his memory, and our study today is dedicated to him as well and to his memory. So we're going to begin chapter 2 of Shar HaYichud V'Emunah, and we've been exploring this text for a number of weeks, and the reason why I chose this text originally is because it is one of the greatest, in my opinion, one of the greatest mystical texts that you and I can study. It talks about the secrets of creation, the fabric of the universe, and so many amazing ideas. Today, we talk about a huge controversy or debate that exists between the Kabbalists and the philosophers. The philosophers, many ancient Greek philosophers and others, believed in a notion of God. But they did not believe in the God that Judaism believes in. They believed in a God, but not in our God. So what's the difference? The God that they believed in was a removed God. It was a God who was not involved with the day-to-day and the nitty-gritty. So gone are miracles, gone are divine intervention, gone is divine providence, all these things out the window. God is not involved. So the ancient Greek philosophers believed in a notion of a first cause, a prime mover, some sort of original force that begins everything. But a God that is involved hands-on day to day, they said, impossible. Why? The way it's explained in Kabbalah is that, frankly, the philosophers were trying to be nice to God. They didn't want God involved in such a messy world. They didn't want God's purity and God's perfection to be somehow mired by the imperfection of the world that we see. And so they said that God does exist, but God exists in a far-off space beyond all the flaws and imperfections and messiness and ugliness of this world. So God started it, but God left it to our own devices. So this explains pain and suffering and tragedy and loss. This explains all of that, according to the philosophers. How can God allow evil to proliferate in this world? Easy. God started it a long time ago, and God left it in our hands. So evil happens, we're doing the evil. Tragedy happens, nature is doing tragedy. God created nature. God started. God got things started once upon a time. But once it started, it's going on its own. It's like, imagine somebody opens up an amazing kosher restaurant at Pond City Market. Anyway, so imagine somebody opens up a restaurant, and they're really prestigious chef or restaurateur, whatever it is. Are they cooking all the meals? Okay, maybe. But you could also imagine, maybe, yeah. But you could also imagine a scenario where they're not cooking all the meals. Who's cooking the meals?
Sous chef.
Or whoever it is. They have other chefs. They create the recipes. They create the ambiance, the style, the direction. They set the tone. And then they leave it in the hands of others who are going to execute, cook the meals, serve the meals, and they stop by, and whatever it is. But otherwise, it's running as it runs. The philosophers believe that God created the world in a similar fashion. God got things running, got things started. God created the laws of nature, created all of the laws of the physical universe that we know and love, and some that we don't love so much. But God created all of those rules, all those laws, and then he set things into motion. Now everything, run with it. According to this understanding, Rambam explains why the ancients began serving idols. Imagine Adam and Eve. Did they know about God? Of course. Were they bowing down to idols? No, they were just busy eating forbidden fruit. But they weren't bowing down to idols. So what happened? Maimonides says, what happened? How did it happen that suddenly you went from monotheism, obvious monotheism, Adam and Eve, they knew where they came from. How do we go from there a few generations later to this idea of idolatry, of polytheism? And Rambam explains, Maimonides explains, that what happened was the ancients were also philosophers. And they said the following. They said that God is too big to be involved in every little thing that happens. Therefore, certainly God has left the workings of heaven and earth in the hands of other forces. The sun, the moon, the stars, the constellations, right? Obviously, us of Hashem es Haaretz, obviously God has delegated, has left the workings of the earth to other forces. So they said, it's appropriate then to bow down to the sun, to worship the sun. If you want light, if you want warmth, bow down to the sun. The sun's in charge. God made the sun originally, but God is not involved anymore. God left the sun to be in charge. Now, so worship the sun. Ask the sun for what you need. The moon, the stars, you know, follow the astrological signs. But the idea is that the ancient polytheists believed that God, that there was a God, but that God delegated, God gave power, God gave, in a sense, choice in the hands of all of these other forces to work to manage the world. Because which CEO is getting involved in every single, you know, low-level decision to actually run things? The CEO, God, is all the way up. God is probably hanging out, playing golf somewhere, Pebble Beach, whatever it is. But God is certainly not involved on a very hands-on, you know, day-to-day level. That's what they believed. Then it got to a certain point where people only knew about the sun, moon, and stars to worship all these other forces. And they forgot, they completely forgot about God, who was on top. Because if you're only worshiping all of these lower, so to speak, lower level entities, then you might at some point totally forget about, you know, the CEO that's ultimately in charge. Judaism maintains that was from the beginning a cosmic mistake. Why? Because God did not delegate the workings of the world to the sun, the moon, and the stars, and to other forces. Rather, God is always hands-on involved. And this is the major point of chapter 2, and it's expressed in more Kabbalistic language, but I'm giving it to you in more discussion type language. Whereas the ancient philosophers and also ancient civilizations, and throughout Torah we see in the book of Genesis, people serving idols, whereas they believe that God is too high and too big to care about and to be involved in all of the low-level stuff that goes on in this world, Judaism, the Jewish belief is that no, God is directly involved in everything that happens. So what's the role of the sun and the moon and the stars? So Kabbalah teaches, Judaism teaches, that it's like kegarzen biyad hachotzev. It's like a hammer in the hand of the chotzev. I don't know. It's like the hammer in the hands of the worker. Imagine. So somebody is building these cabinets or making this new railing, right? They're making it from wood. They're cutting the wood. They're using tools. Would you ever go to that person who's in the middle of creating this, a carpenter is creating this beautiful wood project, would you ever go to them and say, tell me, what kind of tool are you using? Because it seems like this tool is an amazing tool, and I want to thank the tool for all this artistry that's happening, because it's all the tool, and you're not involved, but definitely it's about the tool. You know, that's offensive, right? To the artist, it's offensive. You go to Picasso and you say, what kind of brushes do you use? Because I'm sure if I use the same brushes, I would be as good as you. Or a great photographer. Who's a great photographer?
Ansel Adams.
Ansel Adams?
Yeah.
That was, jinx. You guys were like... imagine... Is that... It's a he?
Yeah.
He or she? He?
Yeah.
Okay, so imagine you go over to Ansel Adams?
Yeah.
Okay. Clearly, I need to brush up my photography knowledge. Anyway, So, and you say to him, what kind of camera do you use? I'm going to buy that camera for Hanukkah, and then I'm going to start taking these world-class pictures. It's a bit of an insult. It's not just the tool, it's the artist behind it. So God utilizes various tools to implement His will in creation, but those tools are nothing but the hammer or the drill or the camera in the hands of the artisan. It's not that the tool is doing it, it's that God is doing it utilizing a tool, but God is doing it directly. This constitutes a major distinction between the perspective of the philosophers and the perspective of Judaism and the perspective of Kabbalah. In fact, as we'll see in chapter 2, Kabbalah maintains that God cannot in any way step out of the world and delegate it to others. If God were to step out for even a moment, the world, as we've explained in chapter 1, the world would revert to utter nothingness. The question is why? The question is why? If you and I create something, if you create a painting, or if you create something out of wood, right? Whoever built this, right? This thing, this railing. They step away, they go home, they go to sleep. It still exists, right? They don't have to constantly be involved in it. So why can't we say that God created a world, delegated it, and stepped out? Why does Kabbalah say, why does Judaism maintain that God needs to be constantly involved in everything? Chapter 2. Let's begin chapter 2. So chapter 2 can be found either in the books on page 25 or in the copies on page 22. The way we do it is, I mainly read the translation that is in the italicized text below the Hebrew. Typically, the paragraphs that are non-italics, either the top paragraph, for example, the top paragraph of chapter 2, or other paragraphs in between, those are kind of commentary, but I'll do my own commentary in between, and I'll mainly just read the translation as it's written here. Here we go, chapter 2. Now, chapter 1, we explain that God is constantly creating and generating the world, bringing it into existence from nothing at every moment. Chapter 2. From the foregoing, in other words, from what we explained before, the answer to the heretics may be deduced. Now, heretics, he means people that deny God's involvement. He calls them heretics. Again, they're not even people who deny God, but people who deny God's constant hashgacha, God's constant involvement and overseeing of things. So here is an answer. It's not an answer, but here is a rebuttal, if you will, to these heretics. And there is exposed the root of the error of those who are deemed heretics, not because they deny that God created the world, but because they deny individual divine providence and the signs and miracles recorded in the Torah. Let me explain. He's saying that this, what we explained before and what he's about to explain, is going to be the retort or the rebuttal to those who deny a truth about God. Which truth? They don't deny that God is originally the creator of heaven and earth. They deny the fact of Hashgacha Pratis. Hashgacha Pratit. What is Hashgacha Pratis? In the Ashkenazi pronunciation. What is Hashgacha Pratis? You know the word Hashgacha? It's a kosher, we use it in kosher. Hashgacha typically means, somebody says, I'm in Trader Joe's, and I found something, this cool new thing that they're carrying, and it's got a hashgacha on it. You know what that means? Not divine providence. It means it has a symbol, a kosher symbol on it. Like the OU, the OK, the like star K. Like a heksher, exactly. Hashgacha, so the heksher means, like it's kosher, it's fit to be kosher, it's fittingly kosher. The hashgacha is also it's also kind of a similar term, but it means that somebody watched it. So that sign is indicating that somebody watched it, observed it, making sure that it was made, manufactured, and in a kosher fashion, utilizing kosher ingredients in a kosher plant, etc. So the author Rebbe said, but in Jewish terminology, Hashgacha Pratis is referring to God. Hashgacha Pratis means individual, specific divine providence, which means that God is overseeing every detail that happens. And I have to explain to you the extent of this. The Baal Shem Tov taught, this is a classic teaching of the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov taught that everything that occurs in this world is by specific divine providence. It's not like some philosophers believe that God is generally overseeing things. I'll give you an example. One time I saw a letter of the Rebbe where the Rebbe refers to this by utilizing terminology of insurance. Insurance. If you are an actuary, what's your job? One of your jobs is to figure out in a group of 100 people, in this demographic, in this health, whatever it is, in this group of 100 people, how many are going to die, to pass away in any given amount of time. The role of the actuary is not to predict who is going to pass away, specifically, but that amongst these people, a certain number are likely going to pass away. Or, let's move it away from human beings. Let's talk about cars, right? Same deal, right? If you insure X number of cars, how many are going to get into fender benders, serious accidents, God forbid, or whatever it is, and then based on that, they figure out what the premium should be based on who it is, what the car is, what the history is, all that stuff. But again, the actuary is not predicting specifically who's going to get into the accident. That we wait for AI to take over and to predict everything and to know everything. But that's coming down the line, right? That's coming soon to a theater near you. So some believed, so the Rebbe uses this notion of insurance, in other words, not specifically who, but that there will be a certain number, to explain why it is that God punished the Egyptians for enslaving the Jewish people. What's the question? The question is the following. God said to Abraham 400 years prior to the Exodus, hundreds of years prior to the slavery in Egypt, God told Abraham, your descendants will be slaves in a foreign land, referring to Egyptian slavery. The Egyptians might then have a claim against God. God, you foretold, and you, in a sense, created that reality of enslavement of the Jewish people. So then how can you punish us? We had to do it. We had no free choice. So the Rebbe explains that although the Egyptians were destined to enslave the Jewish people, no one ever said, Mr. John Frank Egyptian needs to whip an Israeli slave and beat him up. In other words, although the Egyptians collectively were destined to enslave the Jewish people, what was not foretold was the individual enslaved taking part in it. And thus, if an individual chose to be part of that, it's considered as though they chose it with their own, by their own volition, and they're on the hook for that. And that's why they got punished for it. Make sense?
But I mean, I guess not really, because if it's destined, then their free will is taken away from them right then because destined.
But the individual Egyptian didn't have to take part in it. In other words, on the Jews, you're right, it was destined that they be slaves. The question is punishing the Egyptians for taking part in it. So the Rebbe explains that each individual Egyptian who chose to be part of this slavery machine, they chose by their free will to take part in it, they are now culpable for it. Even though in general the Egyptians, this was something they were going to do in general, but the individual wasn't destined that it be them.
But then the Jewish free will is taken away from the Jews.
Yeah,
they have to be
yes.
The only participant.
Well, it's not that. This idea is not really about the Jew. The Jew was, that was decreed against the Jews, that the Jews should be enslaved. On that level, that destiny was predestined. Right, the Rebbe doesn't address that point. You're right. It seems like that was something that was compulsory. Well, no, it was compulsory for them, and it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't something that they chose to enter into.
So, how is the Egyptian that doesn't partake in the slavery? How is he somehow separated from punishment?
You know, it says that amongst the Jewish people, when they left Egypt, there were a bunch of Egyptians that also went with them. They were known as the Erev Rav, the mixed multitude. So there were a bunch of Egyptians that joined ranks with the Jews. Now, it could be that those were the ones that maybe didn't choose to participate. And by the way, it says by some of the plagues, for example, the plague of hail and other plagues, that if the Egyptians would heed the warning and put their animals inside or whatever, they were spared from the plague. So there were outs for the Egyptians as well. But anyway, I only bring that up because that's not what divine providence is. Because divine providence means not that God knows generally what's going to happen, and God decrees, more precisely, that generally there's going to be a bunch of trees and a bunch of animals and human beings, and generally speaking, this is what's going to happen, but everything is, but individually, everything is on their own. Divine providence means that God dictates on an individual level exactly what happens. Now, I know this may then contradict what we just said about the Egyptians having free choice, but that's a bigger question. How does divine providence coexist with free choice? And I will not address that today because I don't necessarily have a good answer for that. But divine providence means that God doesn't just generally dictate or decree what's going to happen, but down to the very detail of what's going to happen. In fact, I started saying this before, the Baal Shem Tov, who was a big teacher and proponent of divine providence, Hashgacha Pratis, individual divine providence, so he explains that everything that happens, down to a blade of grass growing, down to how a leaf that separates from a tree in the wind, how it flutters down to the earth and lands and where it lands, all of that is guided by God. So a far cry from God abandoned the earth, or God delegated the earth to other forces, this notion of divine providence is that God is intimately involved in every single detail. In fact, there's a story of the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, who writes in his memoirs that when he was a young boy, he was walking with his father. They were taking a stroll somewhere in Russia. And his father was teaching him about this teaching of the Baal Shem Tov, that nothing happens without God's individual providence, guiding it. And as this young boy was walking, who would eventually become a Rebbe in his own right, his father, who was then the Rebbe Rashab, the fifth Rebbe of Chabad, so the son started ripping a leaf. He plucked a leaf from the tree and started, ripping it into pieces. That's what kids do sometimes. His father looks at him and he says, just talking about how God guides everything, God empowers and gives life to everything, and you're ripping up something and you're destroying it right there? Come on. So for him, that was a powerful, he writes about it in his memoirs, that it was a very powerful educational lesson, that this notion of divine providence has practical implications. It's not just God is involved in everything, God is, super involved. But if that's the case, then that gives us a responsibility to take care of everything around us and not in any way abuse it, destroy it, harm it, etc. Because if God is involved in everything, even that blade of grass, even that leaf, talk about a responsibility to act like a mensch.
I'm still obsessed with this, not obsessed, trying to process, free will versus God being...
Yeah, guiding everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very difficult question to answer. Because if you say that God is involved in everything except for... Look, the easy way to say it is that God is involved in every detail that happens except for our moral decisions. Those are up to us.
But can I give examples? So, okay, this is a random example. Say that, I have an inkling, just because it literally happened yesterday. For some reason, I don't know why I have, I should go contact that store for tea, right? They want my tea.
Right.
I have no idea. I've never really heard of them. I haven't really, whatever. And then the next day, somebody says, oh, my gosh, here's the name of the buyer of that store. Now, I know that came from somewhere else besides myself.
Right.
However, I have the free will whether or not I follow up on that.
Correct.
So that, to me, is a very clear delineation of, what came from divine intervention and where my free will is. However, if God's already decided, no, your products are yes or no going to be in there, then that makes me sad because it means like I have no free will involved in the process.
Right. Okay. So the easier answer.
That's just an example.
No, that's a great example. Okay. I think the easier way. Again, this is not going to be the complete answer because it goes. There are more. Once you give this answer, there are more questions. It goes deeper and deeper and deeper. But one answer that's given is that we don't truly have free choice over the things, over most things. Only the things that pertain to our moral choices, right and wrong. That's where we truly have free choice. The other stuff, we have to act in order to bring about things that need to happen. But we don't truly have free choice. Look, you know, sometimes you can make the call and make the connection and get the deal. And sometimes you can make the call and you don't get the deal. And who determines that? You could say the other person. But who determines that person, whether they agree to it or not? You know, maybe the mood that they're in that day. And what determines that mood? So many other factors. So ultimately, Kabbalah believes that a lot of things are out of our control. We control what we decide what we're going to do, but that doesn't control the outcome.
So we can control our attitude about it.
Control our attitude. We choose what to do in any given situation, but that doesn't determine the outcome. Whereas when it comes to moral choices of right and wrong, doing the right thing or the wrong thing, that is where we are directly involved in a choice. So it's like we're directly choosing right or wrong. Now, again, there could also be a different outcome, but at least that's to our credit. We did something right or we did something wrong. It's either to our credit or, God forbid, the other side. But otherwise, God controls all those other things. Because again, if you think about it, how many things that, you know, where we are today, I would say most of it has nothing to do with our choice. I mean, starting with the fact that we were born, that wasn't us. I mean, on the most basic level, our existence was not up to us. No one chose to be conceived. It's not a thing, right? So starting from the beginning, it wasn't us. How we grew up, where we grew up, what schools we went to, the friends that we made were usually a product of vicinity, geography, and which schools we went to. Where we went to college is where we got accepted. There's so many factors. I would say most factors in life are out of our control. As human beings, we like to be in control. We want to be in control. And I think it's healthy to be in control on some level. But it's also healthy to know that we ultimately can't be in control of everything. It's also healthy to be able to let go. We definitely have control over our moral choices, right and wrong, how we respond in any given situation. But a lot of this stuff is out of our control. But here we're talking about the idea of divine providence. Is God involved in the goings-on? Is God involved or is God checked out? So he says, the heretics believe that God is checked out. And they deny the signs and miracles recorded in the Torah. They say there's no way that God intervened on behalf of the Jewish people and brought the plagues and split the sea. There's no way. In fact, scientists will tell you it was probably this incredible tsunami that happened or this cosmic shift of the tides, and that's how the sea split. To which I would say, yeah, but who caused the tsunami in the first place? Like, why is that? Why does that change the fact? Yeah.
So they agree that it happened, they just don't believe God.
Yeah, some say that, well, what happened was, you know, this, that, or the other. Or, which again, it's all the physical manifestation of the thing. It's like if somebody sees someone crying and they're saying, well, why? This person is crying, right? So two people are discussing it. So one person says to the other, well, why are they crying? And that person says, well, because the tear duct is, you know, generated tears, and it fell out of the eye, and that's why they're crying. You'll say back to them, thank you for the scientific explanation, but I want to know what's driving it. What stirred that to happen? So, yeah, some crazy cataclysmic event happened, and plagues happened, or sea split. Okay, but why? Don't tell me how, tell me why, and that's a different question. But let's get back inside. So the heretics, what he's calling heretics, they don't believe in divine providence. They don't believe in the miracles recorded in the Torah. So here we go. So what's the where did they go wrong in from the perspective of the Alter Rebbe of Tanya? He says they err in their false analogy in comparing the work of God, the creator of heaven and earth, to the work of man and his schemes. They compare apples to apples, or they think to compare the they think to compare God's creation to human beings' creations. For example, when a silversmith has completed a vessel, that vessel is no longer dependent upon the hands of the smith. Right? You create a silver goblet for Joseph, or you create a silver set of candlesticks for somebody to light Shabbat candles, or a silver menorah or Chanukiah for the holiday of Chanukah. You don't need the silversmith to constantly be creating it at every moment. Why? Because once it's made, it's done. It's finished. Here we go. And even when his hands are removed from it, and he goes on his way, the vessel remains in exactly the same image and form as when it left the hands of the smith. So you create something, you step away, and it remains. In the same way, and he uses harsh language here, in the same way do these fools conceive the creation of heaven and earth. In other words, the error of these philosophers, what he calls heretics, is that they compare the creation of a human being to the creation of God of heaven and earth. And they say that God could have created heaven and earth, and once that's done, God can step away. You make a menorah, a chanukiah, you step away, it's created. God creates the world, steps away, it's still there. He says, however, their eyes are covered. In other words, they're not seeing things clearly, so that they do not see the great difference between the work of man and his machinations, which consist of making one existent thing out of another already existent thing, merely changing the form and appearance of that thing. In other words, for example, from an ingot of silver to a vessel. So he says like this, when it comes to what human beings create, it's all yesh miyesh, something from a prior something. You take silver that existed. I actually never worked silver, so I'm not sure what an ingot of silver is. But it sounds like the raw material of the silver. So you take the raw material, and I guess you heat it, and you hammer it, or you form it in whatever way, and you create a candelabra. So that's not creation. That's reforming something, refashioning something. You took a chunk of silver, and you refashioned it to a menorah. So he says that's merely changing the form and appearance of something from the ingot of silver to a vessel. And that is a far cry, he continues, to the making of heaven and earth, which is creatio ex nihilo. Very poetic there in the Latin, which basically means a creation of something from nothing. Yesh mi yesh versus yesh miayin. This is a very, very big topic in Kabbalah. It's a very important topic. Everything that we do is creating something, yesh miyesh. We take something and we refashion it into a different something. So you take wood and you make a railing. You take stone and you make a countertop. You're taking something that already existed in the natural world and you're refashioning it. Therefore, it exists, since it existed before you, it will also exist, in other words, since it existed before your hands got involved in it, silver was there, wood was there, there was a tree, there was wood, there was stone, the materials existed prior to your birth, prior to your existence, prior to your hands touching it, it existed. It will therefore also exist after your hands get finished touching it. It existed before you, it will exist after you. So you take silver and you make it into a candelabra, you make it into a menorah. Fantastic. It's beautiful. It would not have been a menorah without you. But you can take your hands and take yourself and walk out of the room and drive far away and get in an airplane and go to Timbuktu and it still exists. Why? Because you didn't make it. You didn't make it. You refashioned it. So it doesn't need you. It doesn't need you. You didn't make it. You formed it. Fine. Whereas God created a world, something from nothing. Which means that the essence state of reality is nothingness, is non-existence. In other words, the essence state of the silver menorah is silver, and that exists. That's a something. So it doesn't need you to remain, to retain its existence. But the world, at its core, the essence state of the world is nothingness. Sounds like they're having fun. The essence state of the world is nothingness. So for God to bring the world into existence means that he's bringing nothingness from he's bringing from nothingness into somethingness, or somethingness from nothingness. And therefore, he says, it requires, he doesn't finish it off, but where he's going with this is that it therefore requires a constant force to make it something. Otherwise, it would revert back to its essential nothingness. The example that's given is throwing a stone. The nature of a stone is to sit. If you take a stone and you throw it into the air, so now it's a flying stone. But it's only flying in the air as long as your force is overwhelming its nature. The moment that force is withdrawn, the moment that force disappears, what happens to the stone? We could call it a football also, right? You take a football, you got your Tom Brady jersey on, right? Right, you take a football, you throw it into the air, it goes 60 yards, perfect pass, right? I'm a Steelers fan. Antonio Brown for 6, right? So what happens? It was flying in the air with the energy that was given to it. The moment that energy ends, it starts falling back down to earth, and left to its own devices, in other words, not caught by a wide receiver, left to its own devices, it's going to land, bounce, and remain as still as it was before you touched it. In other words, a thing always goes back to its essential nature. So silver's essential nature is existence. You refashioned it, fine, but it still exists. A flying football, right? A football in the air, that flying footballs, what's its essential nature? Inertness, sitting on the ground. It will always revert back to that nature. So even though for a certain amount of time it's in the air, or a rock, or a stone, or a baseball, or a basketball, whatever it is in the air, or Atlanta United, mazel tov to Atlanta United, for the championship, right? You kick, right? The goalie kicks the ball really far. So it goes in the air. It only goes as long as it goes. And when that energy is done, it lands back down on the ground. So what's the point? The point is, things revert back to their nature. The nature of, what he's saying is, the nature of the entire universe is non-existence. God didn't create the world from earth. God created the earth from nothing. It's not like God took, like, primordial, like, earth matter. And he's like, okay, let me make it into a globe and put a continent here and some water here, but taking all this pre-existing stuff. No. There was nothingness. Absolute nothingness. Such nothingness that our minds can't wrap our heads around it. The nothingness that we imagine is like empty space, which is still something. Empty space is still something. Darkness is still something. We're talking about absolute nothingness that the mind can't grasp because we can't fathom a total undoing of reality and existence. So, but that's what it is. The world did not exist. Nothing existed. And then God created something, and his point is that it's radically different than our creations, which is just repurposing things and reforming things. Then that can exist after we're done with it. But for God to create a world from nothing, something from abject nothingness, his creative power has to constantly be invested into it to keep it going. you've ever been to a science museum, kids' science museum, sometimes they have like wind that's blowing from a thing, like a wind, and you put a ball on top of it, and the ball floats in the air. Have you ever seen that? It's like there's a wind tunnel that's blowing, and have you ever been to that indoor skydiving place in Marietta? iFly? That's fantastic. We took our teens there once a few years ago. Close it. Good to see you. Chag Sameach. Yashar Koach. So, the way that indoor skydiving place works is they have a lot of air. They have a wind tunnel blowing up from the bottom, from the floor. And then you float. Huh? Well, no, now you can hear it more from there because it's going around. Nassim, you're catching some Tanya on the side, on the sly. That's my oldest, Nassim. He's 14 and he's in yeshiva in Chicago. He's visiting for the weekend. Huh? Yeah, for the weekend, for Hanukkah. Yeah, he's like, oh, it's balmy. It's like beach weather. Okay, so again, imagine that wind tunnel, and it's either holding a person floating in the air, you know, the sky, indoor skydiving thing, or it's holding like just a ball, like a small wind tunnel with a ball, like a ping pong ball that's now hovering in the air, and it's super cool. It's like, oh my gosh, how is it hovering in the air? Okay, it's hovering in the air only because of the wind. The moment you block the wind, what happens to the ball, to the ping pong ball? It falls down. Because its nature wasn't changed. Its nature is gravity. It's going to go down. It's only when you have this force constantly pushing it up that it stays up. So the nature of existence, this is the key point. The nature of existence is non-existence. Left to its own devices, existence would undo itself and become revert to non-existence. The football falls down. The ping pong ball falls down. The iFly skydiving person falls down. The nature, things go back to their nature. The nature of all existence is non-existence. The only way it exists is God's constant pumping it into existence. Constant making it exist, constant creation, yesh me'ayin, something from nothing, which demands, this is the point, all of this demands God's constant involvement. Unlike the silversmith, who doesn't need to be involved after he or she forms the candelabra, God needs to constantly be involved to pump existence into existence. He gives an example. He says, creation, he compares it to the splitting of the sea. I mentioned splitting of the sea before. He compares and contrasts creation to the splitting of the sea. Let me tell it to you outside, because it's written in a little bit of a complicated way. But I'll tell it to you outside what he says, and then we'll read it inside. He says, the way the Torah describes the splitting of the sea is that God caused a great wind to blow the entire night, and that wind caused the sea to divide and stand up on both sides like a wall. So although the nature of water is to collapse and to flow, God caused a great wind to make the sea stand up and split. What do we see? That for water to change its nature, for water, which is a liquid, to assume a solid-esque form, requires a force, namely the wind, to constantly reshape it into being. The moment the wind stops, the sea collapses, which is what happened to the Egyptians. God caused the wind all night to go while the Jews were going through. Once the Jews went through and the Egyptians were in the sea, God stopped that wind and the sea collapsed once again. Which tells us that even in our natural universe, to go from sea, not the shining sea, but to go from sea to wall, which is from something to something, it's not from nothing to something, from one nature to another nature, from a liquid to a solid, requires God's constant force. How much more so? Think about it. If you take a bowl of water, a bowl of soup, and you tilt it towards you, the water collects down there. Let's say you want to push all the soup at the top. You have to, let's say you want to, so you blow the soup, you blow the liquid. As long as you're blowing the liquid, it's going to move. The moment you stop, it comes right back down. So even when we talk about something changing its nature radically from something to something, see, silver never changes nature. You make silver into a candelabra, you didn't change its fundamental nature. But to change something from a liquid to a solid requires a constant force. Even if we talk about freezing liquid, right? What happens? You take water, you put it into a freezer. What happens? It started off as a liquid, now it's solid, as long as it's cold enough. If it warms up, what happens? It reverts back. In other words, it reverts back to its nature. It only stays a different state as long as being compelled into that state. The moment you don't compel it into that state, it reverts back to its prior state. And so he says, if this is true, for a thing turning into another thing, something to something, that you constantly need that force, how much more so when you're talking about nothing to something? You see? If this is true, changing a liquid to a solid, the water to a wall, like the splitting of the sea, if you need a constant force for that, how much more so do you need a constant force of God to bring the world in its entirety into existence from abject nothingness? Yeah.
So, manna from heaven, is that Yeshmaeh?
That's a great question. I don't know.
Tell me what's...
I don't know. The manna from heaven, is that something from nothing, or did God utilize something of existence to fashion out of? I don't know. That's a great question.
Is it problematic?
I would say that it's closer to something from nothing, because it's nothing that we know of, at least.
But that has to do with what is essentially what's nothing.
Right, what is nothing? Right. Is it abject nothingness, or is it nothing that we know of, which is different? I know nothing. I'm kidding, I don't know nothing.
Okay,
I don't know which nothing that is. I'm sure, and maybe discussed somewhere. I don't recall seeing it. If the manna was Yeshmaeh or Yeshmaein, I don't know. I'll tell you the joke that's told. This is not about your question, but the joke that's told about the scientists that go to God and they say, "God, it's 2018. We don't need you anymore. We can create life. We can create people. We can create life. We don't need you anymore." And God says, okay, let's do this old school. Let's create people from the earth. I created Adam from the earth. Can you create people from the earth? They said, yes, we can. We can take the earth and create people that are alive. All right, let's do it. God says, you guys go. So they begin, they bend down, they grab some earth, and God says to them, get your own earth. Science is wonderful, but we're using pre-existing stuff. You start off with something, so it's all yesh me yesh. Anything that we create in a laboratory, anywhere, in a workshop, anything that you and I create, that anyone on this earth creates, is from something that already existed. No one's walking into an empty room and creating things poof out of nothing. But that's what God did. And the Alter Rebbe is saying here that that type of creation, which is the only true definition of creation, everything else is just repurposing or, you know, reshaping. God's creation requires constant force propelling it into existence. Let's read the comparison with the splitting of the sea. This creatio ex nihilo, creation of something from nothing, is even more wondrous than, for example, the splitting of the Red Sea. For then, by the splitting of the sea, God drove back the sea by a strong east wind all the night, i.e. the godly force that split the sea clothed itself in the wind. So it's clarified over there that, yes, it was God that split the sea and not the wind. And even though it was the wind, God made the wind go. So it was still God through a wind. But the point is that the sea split how? By virtue of a wind. The wind was blowing it and it separated it. Okay. All right. If God had stopped the wind, the waters would have instantly flowed downward as is their way in nature. In other words, they would have collapsed like they did ultimately, and they would have just flowed like normal. And undoubtedly, they would not have stood upright like a wall. Had the wind stopped blowing, the water doesn't split anymore. Even though, he says, and here's where it gets again in the text, maybe a little bit complicated to read it. He says, even though this nature of water to flow downward is also newly created ex nihilo. In other words, the nature of water to flow versus the nature of a rock to stand still. those natures are also God's creations. So if God created the nature of water to flow, God could certainly supplant it with the nature to stand still like a rock without a wind. Are you with me? In other words, if God, the nature of water is to flow, but who said? Who created that nature? The Alter Rebbe says elsewhere in Tanya, in the first part of Tanya, he says that we use the word nature. Anytime you hit a wall and you can't understand it, you say, well, that's its nature. The nature of hydrogen is to, why? The nature of oxygen is, and when you mix them together, why? That's its nature. Why? Whenever we say nature, it means that we don't know why. That's the furthest we got. We know how it works, we know what it does, the why we don't know, so we call it nature. That's what he says about nature. The nature of water is to flow. Why? Why does water flow and a rock stay solid? Why does a brick wall stay and water poured flow? That's its nature. Why is it its nature? That's how God created it. Something from nothing. That nature is also something from nothing. The nature of water wasn't always to flow. Water didn't exist. So the nature is so theoretically, God could have changed the nature of water to the nature of a rock without the wind. And yet God chose to do it the wind. He says, for a stone wall stands erect by itself without the assistance of the wind, but the nature of water is not so. In other words, the wall doesn't need the wind to keep it up. The water needed the wind. The point is like this, that God changed the nature of water. Sorry, God did not change the essential nature of water miraculously. God just created a wind to blow the water, to keep the water separated like a wall. But I think the implication here is that even if God were to change the nature, that would also be something from nothing, which would also require a constant force to create that nature into, to recreate that nature into something else. Either way, it requires God's constant force to modify something into a different something. So he says, and let's finish this off, how much more so is it in the creation of something out of nothing, which transcends nature and is far more miraculous than the splitting of the sea, that surely, and here we get to the point, that surely with the withdrawal of the power of the Creator from the thing created, God forbid, the created being would revert to naught and utter non-existence. So he says, when God creates things out of non-existence, out of nothingness, it requires a constant force of God. If God were to withdraw that power, it would revert to naught and nothingness as it was before. Rather, the activating force of the Creator must continuously be present in the thing created to give it life and ongoing existence. So here he makes his case for the distinction between the things that human beings create and the things that God created. Human beings can create and walk away, and it stays. I'm looking at the menorah outside. There's a steel or aluminum menorah outside. Whatever metal material that's made out of. Somebody made that a few years ago. We bought it. They're not here. They don't need to be here. It'd be awkward if they would have to be here constantly. Like raise the price on that thing. It's like selling a menorah was going to cost like $300,000. Why? Because I'll need to be there every single day of Hanukkah for the next. No one needs to be there because it wasn't created. It was refashioned. It was formed. It was manipulated. It was altered. It wasn't created. Heaven and earth, this universe, was created by God from nothingness. And when you create from nothingness, you need a constant force bringing it into somethingness from nothingness. And therefore, the Alter Rebbe says, the philosophers who believed that God created the world and checked out, they weren't thinking clearly. How could God check out? How could God create heaven and earth from nothing and then check out? How do you check out? Elsewhere in this text, he likens it to light. And I've said this example, I don't even know how many times I've used this example. But the nature of light is that light only shines. The light only shines when the source is shining. The ray of light only emanates when the source is luminescent. You shut the source, there's no more light. Instantly. So they have now these concerts, these holographic concerts, right? You're watching a hologram on stage perform, sing, play music, the whole deal. So if you pull the plug on that projector, which I'm sure is a massive projector and whatever it is, you pull the plug on that thing, concert goes dark, nothing. Doesn't exist anymore. This entire, again, this is later on in this very text that we're studying, he's going to liken the whole creation to a hologram, to light. Not a hologram, whatever, to light. It's a little bit before holograms were created. But he says that everything is a projection, a light projection from the source. And if the source ceases to project, you don't have, there's nothing exists. So you take metal and you bend it and you put it back. Yeah, bent metal. Mazel tov. It's there. It's sitting there. You project light and you stop projecting the light. Nothing exists anymore. It's gone. It's vanished. That's the difference. So something from something exists after your involvement. Something from nothing requires constant involvement. Let's wrap this up, the discussion for today. He says, these activating forces such as the above are the self-same letters of speech that constitute the 10 utterances by which all beings were created. And this is it. We'll do this last paragraph and we'll close it out. He says, what is the divine energy, the divine force that is compelling the universe into existence at every moment? This is captured in the letters of speech that God is constantly speaking existence into being with. So this is something that we spoke about at length in chapter 1, how the utterances of God, where God says, let there be light, let there be firmament, let there be sun and moon and stars, all of these utterances of God are constantly being uttered, even though we don't hear it, they're constantly being projected into being to create the world and to bring the world into being. Why? Because again, like we said in chapter 2, that without it, the world reverts to nothingness. Because this creation is not at all like the creation of human beings. This is something from abject nothingness, and therefore requires a constant infusion of energy, infusion of light, infusion of divine speech to keep it going. And these constitute the letters of creation that are constantly flowing into existence to give it life. Any questions, comments?
I do have that manna thing, wasn't it? Because didn't one source say that manna was actually not of this world?
Yes. Manna was definitely what we call food from heaven, like spiritual food. It wasn't like the physical stuff that we know of. The question is...
But it was physical.
It was physical. So the question is, were those physical things taken from the elements of this world, or are they brand new? Mm-hmm. I guess everything of this world is on some level brand new. That's the whole point, right? Even a stone would revert to nothingness if not for God's constant recreation. So on some level, everything is brand new. But the question is it a derivation of something that already exists, or is it on its own brand new? That's the question.
So, can you elaborate one more time about how the activating forces, like the letters of speech?
Mm-hmm. So, we're going to pick that up next week. Next week, the chapter continues by getting back into the letters. So, it's a bigger discussion. So, I wanted to just tease it a little bit and then close it out, and then we'll pick it up next week about more about the letters. But the core point today was the distinction between human creation and divine creation. Human creation is not really creation. We took something and we bent it. We took something and we took paint and we mushed it around. It's not to put down any creation, but it's we have to call a thing what it is. It's not true creation. true creation is God's creation, which is starting off with nothing. And that requires a constant force.
Yeah. So it could be that if the manna from heaven is not something from nothing, then ultimately nothing that we can observe is from nothing except the original, the creation.
I think the real point is everything is from nothing. Everything that we see is from nothing. Even the things that we take for granted, like this table, that's solid. That's, I don't know what it is. Plastic. Solid plastic, it too needs to be constantly recreated. Even though a human being formed it, the substance of existence.
But why is it difficult to say the manna from heaven is Yeshua?
I'm only asking the question, was it something that God constituted from prior existing materials that he already created, or is it something that was a brand new existence? I tend to think it was a brand new existence. Which is me.
But that's like, when you look in a microscope and you see the atoms, they're constantly vibrating.
Right.
So that's basically saying, why are they constantly vibrating? Oh, it's just nature. But basically, you can also say the reason they're constantly vibrating is that that's God, quote unquote, keeping it in existence.
Right, right. That there's a constant flow in existence, blinking in and blinking out. Zeros and ones, you know. In, out, off, on, off, on. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. All right. Good stuff. See you next week. Same bat time, same bat channel. Happy Hanukkah. Enjoy. We have a lot of stuff today. I'll announce.